This is Captain Rick reporting. I'll be reading from the Wednesday, February 21st edition of the Decatur Herald and Review. The first article is entitled, Where's OK Guardianship Agreement? Deal means former Amanda Hamm won't retain custody of children, by Edith Brady Lunny of the Herald and Review News Service. Chicago. Amanda Ware and her husband agreed to a guardianship agreement Tuesday that will allow a family member to make decisions about the couple's three children, resolving a nearly three-year legal battle between the state and Ware, whose first three children drowned in 2003 at Clinton Lake. The agreement means Ware will not retain custody of the children. The three children, born since her marriage to Ware, will remain with a member of Leo Ware's family in Chicago, where they were taken after being removed from Ware's home. On Tuesday, a Cook County judge accepted a recommendation from the state that the children remain with the family member, and that the parents be allowed to visit. Leo Ware will have unsupervised visits, but Amanda Ware will be supervised during her time with the two girls, now aged 7 and 5, and a 3-year-old boy. The hearing ends the involvement of the Department of Children and Family Services in the case and transfers care and decision-making to the relative, whom the Bloomington Pantograph agreed not to identify to protect the privacy of the children. Perhaps it's time for us to step out, Carol Casey, court-appointed guardian, said of the state's role in the case. The Wares did not speak during the hearing, other than to acknowledge their agreement to the guardianship. The Wares declined to comment after the hearing, but Leo Ware said he plans to continue efforts to retain custody of the children. The Wares are no longer together, but are involved in their children's lives. Amanda Ware, known as Amanda Hamm before she married Leo Ware, lost custody of her two daughters and their newborn baby brother in March 2014 after a Chicago doctor recognized her from the drowning case that led to murder charges being filed against her and her former boyfriend, Morris Legrone Jr. Ware was in the hospital recovering from the birth of her son when the child welfare investigation began. In separate trials in 2006, Ware was convicted in child endangerment and Legrone was found guilty of murder. She was sentenced to 10 years in prison, but only served about 14 months after she received credit for time served in jail, awaiting trial, and day-for-day credit on her prison term. Convicted of murder by a McLean County jury in 2006, Legrone was sentenced to life in prison in the deaths of Christopher Hamm, Austin Brown, and her sister, Kaylee Hamm, 23 months old, when they were drowned in the backseat of a car that rolled into the lake and sank. Legrone had been driving, and Amanda Hamm was a passenger. In 2016, Cook County Judge Demetrius Koteras ruled the children all under 10 years of age, should remain in state care while the Wares continued their efforts to regain custody. In testimony Tuesday, caseworker Melba Mars said the children have bonded with their caregiver and are doing well in school. The relative, who does not intend to adopt the children, has demonstrated the ability to care for them and is committed to being their guardian, Mars told the judge. In his remarks to the newly appointed guardian, the judge acknowledged that this has put you in a rather awkward position because of her relationship to the family, but he said he was confident that you're going to look out for these kids. The resolution that places the children under a guardianship was one of three options available under the law in the case of suspected abuse and neglect. Children may be returned home, adopted by others, or placed in a guardianship. In the case of the Wares, the children were not eligible to return home because the parents failed to make adequate progress to address issues that they have interfered with their parenting skills, according to the state. The child custody case played out in a Chicago courtroom, including a 2015 trial with testimony from police officers who investigated the 2003 drownings. Although no allegations were lodged against the Wares, Cook County prosecutors argued that the couple's children were in danger of serious harm because of the 2003 case and Leo Ware's criminal background. The couple separated in early 2016. The next article is about education. It's entitled, Second Grader Aces Braille Challenge. Visually impaired Warrensburg-Latham girl is quick study. By Valerie Wells of the Herald and Review. Warrensburg. Olivia Pan Alba wants to be the first blind American ninja warrior. Let me show you how I do push-ups, said the second grader, dropping to the floor in the Warrensburg-Latham Elementary School room where she works with special education teacher Jill Hackman on her braille skills. After the push-ups, Olivia showed off her muscles and kissed her biceps like bodybuilders do. Not much stands between Olivia and her goals, and she may find a way to compete on the NBC show where athletes conquer daunting obstacle courses, said her mother, Sandra Alba. Abla, who homeschools Olivia when she's not with Hackman. Olivia is totally blind in one eye and has limited vision in the other. She can see light and dark, and can read and write if the letters are large enough, and if she holds things close to her face. She started learning Braille in October of 2016, Hackman said. She was in first grade, but had to start with the kindergarten level material, and she finished that in about 2.5 months. Then she went into first grade material. She's a very fast learner, probably the fastest Braille learner I've ever worked with, and this is my 20th year of teaching. When Hackman heard about the Braille Challenge, a national program of the Braille Institute in California, she knew it was perfect fit for Olivia. It was spelling tests and proofreading and normal reading, and I answered the questions, Olivia said. Olivia won her age group and was awarded an iPad, gift cards, a stuffed animal, socks, and candy. The iPad will be especially helpful for her, her mother said, because of apps that will enlarge printed words for her and speak aloud to make using it easier for her. Reading visually is hard on her eyes, Sandra Abla said. Her eyes get very tired. The walls of Hackman's special education room at the school are lined with squares of paper representing all the words Olivia knows in Braille, along with pictures of the Braille representation of those words. She takes a spelling test every week, and in second grade, Olivia said, she has to know 15 words a week. In first grade, it was only 10. She is adept with the Braille writer and readily shows off her speed and accuracy. The Braille Challenge is designed to encourage blind students to emphasize their study of Braille and requires students to complete various tasks such as proofreading. That one, at first, threw Olivia for a loop. There weren't any errors, Olivia said. Hackman laughed and explained that Olivia had accidentally been given a piece without errors, and while neither Hackman nor Sandra Alba could be in the room during the challenge, they heard about it afterward. The judges gave Olivia a different piece to proofread. The challenge previously was in Chicago, but this year it was February 8th in Jacksonville, a more convenient location for area parents, Hackman said. It's also where the Illinois School of the Visually Impaired, the Illinois School for the Deaf, and the Philip J. Rock Center and School, which serves several children who are blind and deaf are located. Braille was developed by Louis Braille, who was born in 1809, according to the American Foundation for the Blind, based in Arlington, Virginia. He attended the National Institute for Blind Youth in Paris, where books for the blind were created with raised print, but those were difficult to produce and read. Braille based his new method on the Etrian Nocturne night code used on the battlefield for military messages sent at night. Using a series of raised dots in specific configuration, Braille is used all over the world in various languages. English-speaking countries adopted a common format known as Unified English Braille in 2016. Books for the blind are much larger and heavier than printed books. A book such as the Bible, for example, can require several volumes. Yet the Braille writer that Olivia uses is small and has only a few keys, which she holds down in different combinations to create the Braille letters and signs that indicate capitalization or numbers. Sighted people can learn to read Braille visually while the blind use their fingers. Sandra Obla is learning Braille too, but admitted with a laugh that it's uphill work and Olivia is far better than she is. Assisting students. Kathy Horath, Director of Special Education in Macon-Piatt Special Education District, said 24 area students had significant visual impairments and received services from one of the district's two trained teachers. She said instruction and support includes, but is not limited to, learning to use accommodations, learning to read and write in Braille, navigating assistive technology, providing materials, adaptation such as Braille to print, print to Braille and enlarged materials, learning how to navigate safely in the community and school via white cane training. The majority of students who are visually impaired attend their regular school with one of two teachers, she said. The teachers travel to the various schools, providing instruction, usually about 2 hours a day. Karen says goodbye to basketball. Millikan team gives departing coach a winning tribute. By Mark Tupper of the Herald and Review. Everyone has been asking the same question. How is Laurie Cairns going to handle this? It's a fair question when a person decides to retire from coaching after 32 years, even if she's just 54, and even if she will continue working at Millikan University. This is all she's ever done. This is who she is. But as her final game approached on a rain-drenched Tuesday evening at Griswold Center, there was another question worth asking. How is Bob Cairns going to handle this? It's virtually impossible to know Laurie Cairns and not know her father, who has taken this remarkable journey with her every step of the way. He taught her to play the game, coached her at Newton High School, followed her religiously as a college player, and supported her with a devotion that has earned him the name Coach Bob from current and former players. When I ask him, when is the last time either of you had a hands-on relationship with basketball, because that's the new deal starting today. But Bob thought and thought and thought. I can't say because we've had a hands-on relationship with basketball at least since Laurie was 4 years old, he said. She'd shoot the ball on a basket that was 4 feet high off the ground and mounted to a pump hose. When she got bigger, she shot on a regular height basket mounted on a light pole on our driveway. Lori, her mom, and I would go shoot baskets to see who had to do the supper dishes. Her mom stopped playing, so it was just Lori and me. That's why Bob is so adept at scrubbing pots and pans. It's been a good run, he said on a night that was plenty emotional for him. I never thought a dad would be involved with his kid in a sport for all those years, and 36 of them right here. That's 4 years as a player and 32 as a coach. Fate and geography kept parents and their daughters in such close touch. At one point, as she was getting ready to graduate from high school, Lori considered a college in Florida. Dad immediately checked the distance between the college and Florida's top largemouth bass honey holes, and it was tempting. But the conclusion was clear. Florida is a great fishing state, but that was just too far, he said. So she took a look at Milliken, then another, and she was hooked. She always loved the place. I can still see why she does. Some readers will take this the wrong way, and I'll take my chances with that. But a trip to a Milliken basketball game is a reminder that in the middle of some craziness, in big-time college sports, a little hometown, homegrown, neighbor-to-neighbor friendliness still has a place in our world, and in our college sports. Instead of the big video tributes we've seen in Division I gym or in the NBA, there was a solitary sign about 4 feet by 2 feet, simply lettered to say, "Thank you, Coach." A few blue and white balloons were tied to the railings of them in the bleachers. Instead of state-of-the-art sound blaring hip-hop and thump-thump, there was an opening volley of country music. Instead of fans acting too cool to care, there was a woman who braved the driving rain and snuck in through the back door to bring Coach Cairns a homemade gooseberry pie. There were fans hugging in the aisles, just as they have done for decades. There were grandparents and grandchildren, college students and grade schoolers. And I hope Milliken will never apologize for comfortably and sanely bridging the gap from high school to college. No wonder families feel comfortable sending their children there. Before the game, Lori Cairns was worrying more about keeping the focus on senior night, the final home game for 6 senior players. She started 5 of them and would have started all 6 if the rules allowed it. She swore she had no emotional pregame speech, but worried about what she would say after the game when they handed her a microphone and expected her to perfectly summarize her 32-year career in less than 3 minutes. On the final night of her coaching life, a night it rained so hard the Griswold Center roof leaked repeatedly into the playing floor, Lori Cairns' players gave her the finest tribute they could have. They played in a way that made her beam with pride. Not only did Milliken beat North Park 85-66, they hustled at both ends, dug rebounds out of traffic, deflected passes, and found open shooters. They made shots the way she once upon a time did, on a basket nailed outside her family home. They played with enthusiasm, and the crowd loved it, standing and cheering the effort. On her farewell night as a basketball teacher, the students aced the final exam. Walk away proud, Coach. The next article is entitled Plan. Require rear facing car seats until age 2. Sarah Zimmerman of the Associated Press, Springfield. The Illinois Senate endorsed a measure Tuesday night tightening car seat regulations in an effort the sponsor said will better protect children in the event of a collision. The Senate Public Health Committee voted 7-0 to require children 2 and younger to sit in rear-facing car seats while riding in the back seat of a vehicle. The children under the age limit are exempt if they weigh 40 pounds or more, or if they are 40 inches or taller. The measure would amend the 1983 Child Passenger Protection Act, which currently states parents are only responsible for providing an appropriate child safety seat to children under 8. Senator Michael Hastings, a Tinley Park Democrat, said the existing law is too vague. This bill codifies what the Pediatric Association has recommended, said Hastings, who is also father to a 2-year-old. It's also an opportunity to educate our families that are having newborns on the right way to take care of their child. Accidents do happen, and we don't want our kids to get hurt. The American Academy of Pediatrics recommends parents to keep children in rear-facing car seats until age 2, unless they meet or surpass the maximum height and weight requirements. The seats are designed to absorb and distribute the force of a collision across the entire body, better protecting a child's head, neck, and spine. Dr. Eddie Point, the legislative chair of the Academy's Illinois chapter, said the rear-facing seats reduce risk of injury by 71%. He noted many parents switch their children to forward-facing seats too early, and that this measure reflects what the current science supports. The skeleton of a child is less mature and is best supported by a rear-facing car seat, he said. The most vulnerable parts of the body are shielded from the energy of the collision. Democratic and Republican senators both took issues with the fact first-time violators would be hit with a $75 fine, saying too many parents would be punished by a law that they weren't informed about. Hastings said the fine would be waived if parents proved to a court that they completed an educational child safety course. The primary goal is to make sure the kids are safe, and it's not to penalize people, said Hastings. Senate committee members moved the bill forward under the agreement Hastings changed the first violation offense from a fine to a warning. They also asked for more information on public education efforts and if it's possible to provide free or subsidized car seats to parents in need. 9 states require rear-facing car seats until age 2, including California, New York, South Carolina, and Oklahoma. Some states, such as Texas, provide free car seats to low-income families that attend a class on child passenger safety. Brothers accused in Glen Carbon death, by the Associated Press in Edwardsville. 2 brothers from St. Louis have been charged in the death of an acquaintance whose body was found in their Glen Carbon, Illinois home. In Glen Carbon. First-degree murder charges were filed against 29-year-old Ralph Evans and 31-year-old Julius Evans in the death of 45-year-old Tyrone Grady, also of St. Louis. Madison County Sheriff John Lakin on Tuesday refused to detail the shooting or a possible motive, but said an overdose death on February 8th of a St. Louis woman is connected. Authorities did not specify the relationship between the woman, the Evans brothers, and Grady, other than saying the 4 have been acquainted for years. Authorities say the men have been in custody since February 14th and were formally charged on February 16th. The warrants for the arrest were sealed until Tuesday. The brothers are being held in lieu of $2 million bail. Mattoon murder trial begins. Man charged in the shooting death of Charleston Sierra F. Fairs by Dave Fulpe of the Herald and New Review News Service. Charleston. Testimony is set to begin Wednesday in the trial of a Mattoon man accused of killing a woman with shots that police say may have been meant for someone else. James Todd Schaefer faces charges of first-degree murder and other offenses in the June 18, 2016 shooting death of Sierra F. Fairs at an apartment building in the 300 block of South 21st Street in Mattoon. Schaefer, 26, might have been returning fire in a confrontation involving others, according to previous police testimony. But the 23-year-old Charleston woman was hit and died later at Sarah Bush Lincoln Health Center. Jury selection took place on Tuesday for Schaefer's trial that's expected to last into next week. He faces at least 45 years in prison, with a life sentence the possible maximum, if convicted of the murder charges against him. Also charged in the shooting is Sean D. Adamson, 35. His trial is set for March 5th. Adamson is also charged with first-degree murder, but isn't accused of fatally shooting Fairs. Police say he caused the incident that led to the shooting by going to the apartment building to confront Schaefer about stealing a gun from him. Fairs, who was Schaefer's girlfriend, had just left the apartment after an argument with Schaefer, but was still outside when shots were exchanged, according to evidence from earlier hearings in the case. That also included that Adamson might have fired a gun once from outside the apartment, and that led Schaefer, who was inside, to return fire. Two other men, Matthew S. Cook and Kevin W. Johnson, were also arrested in connection with the incident, but reportedly accompanying Adamson to the apartment building to help confront Schaefer. Both Cook and Johnson later pleaded guilty to reduced charges based on what prosecutors indicated better reflected their actual roles. Robbery suspect arrested, Decatur. A robber who implied he was armed was arrested within minutes of holding up a gas station convenience store early Tuesday morning, according to Decatur police. Patrol officers had been detailed to the Circle K gas station, 1141 East Wood Street, around 1:07 a.m., after a female staff member reported being held up at 1:03 a.m. While the reporting officer was on scene speaking with the attendant, who was the victim, other officers located a subject a block away who matched the suspect description, said Detective Sergeant Chris Copeland. The Circle K attendant and another witness both identified the 48-year-old man as the robber. He was still carrying 24 boxes of cigarettes, valued at $185, that Copeland said he had grabbed during the robbery. Man sentenced for threats, East St. Louis. An Illinois man will get mental health treatment and substance abuse counseling after pleading guilty to making online threats against President Donald Trump. Joseph Lynn Pickett of Edwardsville was also ordered to spend 6 months behind bars for the June threats, though he's already served the time since his arrest last year. And that's the end of part one of the Wednesday, February 21st edition of the Decatur Herald and Review. This has been Captain Rick reporting. I'll be back with part two after the break.